Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Along with Jim Garrity of National Review, I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We've got all crazy martinis today on the first Monday of the Trump administration. We should also tell you that we're sponsored today by Simply Safe Home Security. A little bit later, we'll be telling you about a great deal where you can save $200 off their best-selling Defender security package. Jim, I hope you're rested and ready after what I'm sure was a full week end of Trump inaugural events that you attended.
You know, if it wasn't the excitement of the Trump inaugural, Greg, it was the excitement of those really competitive championship games at the NFL this weekend.
Well, that's true. It's
blowouts.
It's the Patriots and the Falcons. The Falcons, I think, had that one sewn up pretty much, well, certainly by halftime. And the Patriots pulled away shortly after halftime. But good news for the Jets. The Jets and the Bears obviously did not come anywhere close to the playoffs this year. But your owner, Woody Johnson, is Trump's choice to be ambassador to the UK. And Dan Rooney was Obama's choice to be ambassador to Ireland. And as soon as he was, they immediately won a Super Bowl and then went back a couple of years later to another Super Bowl. So things are looking up for the Jets.
I hope it works that way, Greg. My fear is it works the other way around, that as soon as Woody Johnson becomes the U.S. ambassador to the United Kingdom, that you end up having lots of problems, personnel issues, a losing record. It's a rebuilding year for the U.S.-UK relationship. And most importantly, my fear is I expect a lot of diplomatic communiques will be intercepted over the next couple of years.
Well, at least we know what we're getting into before it even starts. So let's get into our three crazy martinis. Jim, of course, the inauguration was on Friday. Saturday evening, we had the interesting event of the press is assembled on a Saturday evening. You think something pretty significant is going to happen here. Maybe the president has signed some executive orders, rolling back some of the key Obama policies. Who knows what this could be? But Sean Spicer instead decides to use it as an opportunity to give the press a tongue-lashing, first on the decor of the Oval Office.
Some members of the media were engaged in deliberately false reporting. For all the talk about the proper use of Twitter, two instances yesterday stand out. One was a particularly egregious example in which a reporter falsely tweeted out that the bust of Martin Luther King Jr. had been removed from the Oval Office. After it was pointed out that this was just plain wrong, the reporter casually reported and tweeted out and tried to claim that a Secret Service agent must have just been standing in front of it. This was irresponsible and reckless.
And reckless. Okay, but there's at least one more topic he's going to get to here. This one clearly has more meat to it, I'm sure.
Secondly, photographs of the inaugural proceedings were intentionally framed in a way, in one particular tweet, to minimize the enormous support that had gathered on the National Mall. This was the first time in our nation's history that floor coverings have been used to protect the grass in the mall. That had the effect of highlighting any areas where people were not standing, while in years past, the grass eliminated this visual.
And Spicer then says, you have no idea how many people were at the inauguration.
Inaccurate numbers involving crowd size were also tweeted. No one had numbers because the National Park Service, which controls the National Mall, does not put any out.
But apparently he has numbers.
We know that from the platform where the president was sworn into 4th Street holds about 250,000 people. From 4th Street to the media tent is about another 220,000. And from the media tent to the Washington Monument, another 250,000 people. All of this space was full when the president took the oath of office. We know that 420,000 people used the D.C. Metro public transit yesterday, which actually compares to 317,000 that used it for President Obama's last inaugural. This was the largest audience to ever witness an inauguration, period, both in person and around the globe.
So if you factor in TV, maybe it was. I think most people agree that Obama, certainly in 2009, was the biggest in recent memory. Jim, who cares? Why would you call this moment to bring the press in to scold? Obviously, it's going to be an adversarial relationship. It was throughout the campaign. It's not going to be the love fest that it was for the past 8 years. But this is just a bizarre foot to get off on.
Greg, do people pay more attention to you or do they put more faith in what you say if you end your statement by declaring aloud the punctuation that follows that statement?
I guess so.
I don't think it does! Exclamation point. And I wonder what Spicer was doing here. Ellipses. talk about reading your stage directions. Not like, okay, so Greg, if the crowd at the inaugural is less than 600,000 people, does President Trump not get to use the veto as often? Does he not get to appoint people with advice and consent? With the, does it change anything about his presidency if the media spends a lot of time going, yeah, yeah, your crowd wasn't as big as Obama's?
No.
It changes nothing. And yet this is what, you know, Spicer and the administration want to, you know, have their first big battle at. And I wrote in today's Morning Jolt that, you know, that's what, you know, Trump spent a good chunk of his time at the CIA in front of the memorial wall talking about. And it just, one, for Trump, it wasn't the time and the place. And two, let's be cynical, Greg, and let's say that every administration lies. Every administration at some point is going to go out in front of the public and tell something that is less than 100% true. Now, would you rather do it on, this was the biggest audience for an inauguration ever, period, exclamation point, umlaut, ampersand, you know? Or would you like to say, if you like your plan, you can keep your plan? Right? Lying is wrong, Greg. We're not saying the Three Martini Lunch endorses lying. We're just saying that if you're going to lie, make sure you get something out of it. Right? Make sure that it does something to advance your interest. Because at this point, the only thing that's threatened by, yeah, yeah, your crowd was small, is Trump's ego. And I'd like to think that a White House has a higher priority than the president's ego, and it doesn't appear to have that. Spicer got a lot of grief over it. Spicer got a lot of mockery over it. I just don't, you know, we'll see how things shake out from here between him and the press, but I think they now think of him as somebody who makes ridiculous statements. Now, Greg, I was talking about this with Hugh Hewitt this morning. Maybe Spicer comes out today, looks at the assembled press corps and says, I want to thank the millions and millions of you for coming here. And also know that tomorrow's briefing will be slightly delayed as I have an optometrist appointment. So maybe he can laugh this off, but I think, you know, it's not just the inaccuracy of the statement. Because even if you want to say, look, you don't know the exact crowd. Okay, but you could use the Metro ridership numbers as a measuring stick. It may not be the perfect measuring stick. And here's the other thing is, I don't think it really matters if Trump's crowd is smaller, because there are all kinds of reasons you could say, well, a good portion of Trump's, you know, most popular states at his base live further away from Washington, D.C. Washington, D.C. is a very Democratic area. I'm not the least bit surprised that the Women's March had a bigger crowd, because there are more people who are really PO'd about Donald Trump who live in this area and are willing to come out in the middle of winter and do it. Now, the really interesting measuring stick for this, Greg, is going to be, how does the media cover the March on Life on Friday? Because unless everybody who's pro-life in the country has the flu, you're going to have a couple hundred thousand and maybe even a million people there. And you'd think that would warrant some coverage of that. But we'll see how this shakes out. But it just seems like a really bizarre hill to die on for Spicer, and a really awkward way to kick off his debut in the White House.
Jim, he didn't lie. He used alternative facts. We know that now.
Yes.
Secondly, I think he has now Trump's Twitter account come to life and goes beyond 140 characters. And finally, I guess as an exit, at least from my perspective here, is that we've been chiding the media ever since the election to go nuts over things that matter. And as you made the point with Spicer, do it over something not only that you're going to get something out of, but over something that matters to the American people. Job numbers aren't going to change because of the crowd size at inauguration. Our standing in the world, our border security isn't going to change because of the numbers of the people that showed up on Friday. So bizarre, bizarre for sure. All right, on to the second crazy martini now. And you mentioned the Women's March on Saturday. We had kind of had some fun with the people who were considered lesser participants in the march. In fact, there was a dust up a few days earlier basically saying that you can't be a pro-life feminist. So you can't be a pro-life feminist and be part of this march. White people had to step back and listen in the march. And ultimately, we got a lot of people on the mall. But I'm still not really sure what the message is. Madonna went on for about 5 minutes or so here. We got a couple of clips. If you can tell me if she understands what the march is about, you're better than I am.
Welcome to the revolution of love. To the rebellion. To our refusal as women to accept this new age of tyranny, where not just women are in danger, but all marginalized people. where being uniquely different right now might truly be considered a crime. It took this horrific moment of darkness to wake us the f*** up.
And then, of course, this is the line she's most famous for now.
Yes, I'm angry. Yes, I am outraged. Yes, I have thought an awful lot about blowing up the White House.
And then she says, but that wouldn't really change all the despair that we're in. Jim, there was also a lot of, let's say, odd costuming depicting different parts of the female anatomy that they're very, very proud of. So in the end, you write about how this could potentially be the left's version of the beginning of the Tea Party movement in an obviously very different way. But if they were looking to win people over that hadn't sided with them before, I'm not sure the tone and the pictures coming out of this are the best ways to accomplish that.
Madonna talking about blowing up the White House is the lamest sequel to Independence Day ever. Look, you know, I decided it wouldn't change policies. Also, Madonna, it would be terrorism. So that's another reason, strikes me as a good reason, to not pursue that course of action. I was thinking about back in 2009 when Obama got elected, and a lot of Republicans, a lot of conservatives, just for that first couple of months felt shell-shocked, right? They just couldn't believe. There's the Newsweek cover that says, we are all socialists now. It feels like there had been this, the world had turned upside down. And then you had the Santelli rant on CNBC, and gradually, like, conservatives started coming together at those first Tea Party rallies. A lot of them launched on, the groups launched on April 16th, Tax Day 2009. And it felt good to be around people who agreed with you. You just had this terrible defeat from top to bottom, you know, president, Senate, House, gubernatorial races. You've just had this terrible election cycle, and you feel like, oh, my goodness, what if my values and my ideas and my agenda, and my way of how America is supposed to be, what if it really is on the way out? What if I'm, you know, the past and the world is moving beyond me? So then you get together at the Tea Party rally and you suddenly realize, oh, no, I'm not alone. I'm not some lunatic. There are a lot of people who feel the way I do. There are a lot of people who feel the way I do, and they're passionate about this and they're strong about this. That's, people say, oh, how can you compare these things? Well, that's the phenomenon I think you saw amongst progressives at the March on Washington, Women's March on Washington this weekend, and various other cities around the country. It's not a value comparison or an agenda comparison. Well, the other thing is that the Tea Party rallies, a lot of people said, ha, you know, so what are the Tea Parties really about? Some people say it's about Obamacare, but other members say it's about taxes. Still more think it's about the bailouts. This is incoherent, you know. Well, there's a lot of the same, you know, broad diversity. I put it in terms of smorgasbord of agenda items at the women's rally. But generally, they're all pretty much on the left, and they're all pretty much, we hate Donald Trump. They hate Donald Trump's economic policies. They hate Donald Trump's foreign policies, immigration policy. And so the entire rallying cry of the Tea Party movement was broadly, we don't like what Obama is doing. And I think you're going to see this nascent progressive grassroots movement that's all based around, we don't like what Trump is doing. Now, is this going to get them, mean they're going to win the 2018 midterms? A lot of road ahead. We'll see how things shake out. I think a lot of it more is going to have to do with what is the condition of the country then. But I do think there's something that is going on here that conservatives and Republicans probably ought to keep an eye on and just be aware that, you know, things can change dramatically in 2 years. Look at 2004 to 2006. Look at 2008 to 2010. Look at 2012 to 2014. Midterms have this ability to sneak up on you. But the second thing is, like, if Madonna's running around talking about blowing up the White House, that is the best gift the Trump administration can get, because that's not going to be the sort of thing that people really buy into. And all of the ludicrously violent protests we saw on Inauguration Day was another great way of kind of isolating the left from the American mainstream. So if you're hoping for sane opposition to any of Trump's agenda, you're right now, you're out of luck. It looks like liberals have learned next to nothing from the 2016 elections.
Now, if you're president of the United States and Madonna's threatening to blow up your house, you shouldn't have to worry about it too much, because there's a lot of security around there. You got the Secret Service, you've got aerial coverage, there's a lot of surveillance going on there. Probably don't need an additional home security system. But a lot of times people who want to go after your house don't get up on a stage and yell into a microphone that they want to blow up your house or rob your house or do damage to you or your family. So it might just be smart to get that done, get that security in place before the threat ever emanates. Now that it's 2017, maybe you're making some New Year's resolutions. But here's one that I think you'll really like. It's easy to keep and your whole family benefits. Protect your home with our favorite award-winning home security, SimpliSafe. Now, they've extended their huge holiday sale for the new year, and that means $200 off the best-selling Defender security package.
This is a 17-piece system of pure protection. With around-the-clock alarm monitoring and police dispatch, the minute your home faces danger, you will know about it, and SimpliSafe calls the police. SimpliSafe was built by a Harvard-educated engineer. His friends got robbed, and when they couldn't find home security that wasn't a ripoff, he started this company.
Make sure that your home stays safe. There's no long-term contract, no hidden fees, and nothing to hold you back. Now you can get this award-winning security system for $200 off. SimpliSafe never has deals this big. Go now to simplisafe.com/ricochet. That's spelled SimpliSafe.com/ricochet. But you gotta hurry. This is for a limited time only. Save $200 at simplisafe.com/ricochet. All right, on to the third and final crazy martini for the day. Jim, it was just, gosh, about 10 days ago, maybe a little bit more than that, that Marco Rubio was absolutely grilling Rex Tillerson in front of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He was completely flabbergasted at the idea, for example, that Tillerson couldn't immediately say that Vladimir Putin was a war criminal for what he had perpetrated in Aleppo.
Based on all this information and what's publicly in the record about what's happened in Aleppo and the Russian military, you are still not prepared to say that Vladimir Putin and his military have violated the rules of war and have conducted war crimes in Aleppo.
Now, those are very, very serious charges to make, and I would want to have much more information before reaching a conclusion. I understand there is a body of record in the public domain. I'm sure there's a body of record in the classified domain. And I think in order to deal with a serious question like this,
Mr. Tillerson, what's happened in Aleppo is in the public domain. The videos and the pictures are there.
Fully informed before advising the president.
Well, what a difference a couple of weeks makes. Rex Tillerson is pretty much a lock now for Secretary of State. Marco Rubio posting on his Facebook page earlier on Monday that despite his misgivings and reservations, quote, "I will support Mr. Tillerson's nomination in committee and in the full Senate." He says, given the uncertainty that exists both at home and abroad about the direction of our foreign policy, it would be against our national interest to have this confirmation unnecessarily delayed or embroiled in controversy. So he was pretty much the last holdout. John McCain had previously said he'd vote for Tillerson when pigs fly, and apparently they're flying because I think he's on board too. Lindsey Graham had been hesitant about it. So, Jim, a lot of smoke, but apparently not much fire there.
Yeah, look, on the one hand, I can see precisely the perspective of Rubio at each moment of this. There was good real. This is what confirmation hearings are for, right? You know, if you want to be part of the president's party and ask questions that are variations of Mr. Nominee, why are you so awesome? How can you be so awesome, and how are you getting even better each day? Or you can ask real questions. And Tillerson is a very non-traditional choice for Secretary of State, a name that a lot of Republicans were not terribly familiar with, not the kind of background you would expect in a potential Secretary of State, and perfectly fair questions. And I think some of Tillerson's answers were, you know, not 100% reassuring. I had less of an issue with the wariness or reluctance to say that Vladimir Putin was guilty of war crimes or calling him a war criminal. And I think more concerned that he kept insisting that Exxon never, when he was at ExxonMobil, they didn't lobby. They just told lawmakers the consequences of policies. Okay, yeah, because you know, when you tell you something, oh, this, if you enact this policy, it's going to be terrible, but I'm totally not lobbying against it. Okay, you know, don't pee on my leg and tell me it's raining. But other than that disingenuousness, look, you know, McCain is on board. Lindsey Graham is on board. Most Republicans have decided, all right, I don't know if Al Franken will back him, but he seems good enough, smart enough, and doggone it, people like him. We'll see what happens with Tillerson. But the general principle is right that usually you give the president the nominee he wants, unless you've got a really good reason to say, no, this guy is going to be a disaster in this job. The problem is that it's Rubio. And that Rubio in the past said he was definitely running for president. There was no way he was going to run for re-election. And of course he did. He was the guy who said that any path to citizenship was pretty much amnesty. That's in his initial campaign back in 2010. Then he became part of the Gang of Eight. Then he voted for the Gang of Eight, offered this kind of, you know, pablum speech on the floor that didn't really address any of the details of the bill, but about how proud he was of his father. And then once it was in the House, he kind of told that it was fine with the House not passing it because he clearly had concerns with it. And it just seemed like this flipping, flopping, flipping, flopping. And these are, you know, challenging enough issues. You could look at Tillerson and say, ah, you know, he really is on the line of whether he's okay or not. But when you go at him in a hearing, you know, you sound a little bit like Emily Letella of saying, oh, I don't like these answers, but never mind. And so, you know, Tillerson looks like a done deal. Time to knock on wood and hope for the best. Hopefully he will turn out to be a great Secretary of State. But if he turns out to be a bad one, people will kind of look at Rubio and say, hey, wait a minute, right? If anybody was going to save us from this, if anybody was going to lead the charge against him, it was you. And you certainly sounded like you were going to do that in the hearing. And then in the end, you voted for him, contending that ultimately deep down, there's very little, at least when it comes to the cabinet, no Republican serious opposition to Trump's picks. And if they turn out to be great picks, wonderful. If they turn out to be bad picks, this is going to blow up in the Republican Party's face, whether it's 2018 or 2020.
Quite a start to the week, huh?
We're on day four of the Trump era.
Buckle up, everybody. This is going to be intense pretty much the whole way through, and we'll be glad to guide you through it and offer our perspectives along the way. Jim, talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today, and be sure to tune in again on Tuesday for the next Three Martini Lunch.